start with this chart, really, that's just helping us to put these Old Testament prophets in their proper place time-wise and associate them with the particular kings in whose reigns these prophets prophesied. If we're talking about Micah, as we are this evening, what prophets would you associate with the time period of Micah? You have to remumble that one. All right, those are the kings. I'm asking about the prophets right now. Yeah, I did kind of switch unexpectedly there. Okay, Isaiah would certainly be the contemporary prophet with Micah. Is Micah prophesying for the southern kingdom or the northern kingdom? Well, he lived in the southern kingdom, okay, just like Isaiah did. Again, when you kind of put all these prophets in perspective, you can think of Amos and Hosea prophesying to the northern kingdom. Isaiah is a prophet down south. And also Micah, then, is his younger contemporary. In fact, if you just look at the prophecy of Micah, the very first verse, it sets the time period for you. The word of the Lord which came to Micah of Moresheth in the days of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. And so Isaiah's prophetic ministry really extended back a little bit earlier, even to the time of the reign of Uzziah, at least the last year of Uzziah's reign. And so Micah, a little bit younger contemporary. But again, if you just kind of keep these four prophets in your minds as prophesying in the same basic period of time, I think that will be of help to you. All right. The verse that we just read talked about Micah being from the city of Moresheth, and that's over here along this coastal area here, not exactly certain where it is, but somewhere in this area. Where did Isaiah chiefly prophesy during his ministry? Jerusalem. Isaiah is the more major prophet, the counselor to the kings, and he's prophesying mainly in the capital city. Micah, though, at least he's from that city of Moresheth, as the text says, so we would presume that that's where he chiefly did his prophetic work. And everybody has the outline here of Micah, and I think that this is a helpful thing to do, is just to kind of look at the basic content of the oracle. The first two chapters, Micah talks about judgment on Samaria and Judah. What's Samaria? All right, it's a city, though. Capital city of the northern kingdom of Israel. So what you see, I think someone made this point earlier, even though Micah or even though Isaiah are actually living in the southern kingdom, a lot of what they will have to say will have reference to the northern kingdom and its fall, God's judgment upon them. And certainly here's a good example, judgment on Samaria as well as Judah. And then chapters 3 through 5, talking about the present devastation that is going to come upon them, and then future exaltation. And we'll look some more at some passages that talk about that. So often what these prophets do is talk about the impending judgment from God, but most of the time they will give a positive evaluation of the distant future. Once the people truly repent and when God works his ultimate plan, there will be future exaltation. So we'll look at that more in just a moment. And then chapter 6 and 7, and I don't really think I'm going to have time to really go into those chapters, but they really are an interesting chapter, because here's a case that you see even Isaiah doing in his prophecy, where Isaiah's prophesying on behalf of God, and God's suing the nation. He's taking them before the law court, so to speak. He's presenting his case as to what he has against them. So it's in that legal kind of setting, that legal kind of metaphor, where Yahweh brings his case against Israel to explain why he has every right to judge them. because they have wronged him. So this is an overview of the oracle of Micah. And so I want us to look at this now in some more depth. I tell you what, before we get down to those verses, go ahead and just look with me at the very beginning of this oracle, starting with verse 2. Hear, O peoples, all of you, listen, O earth, and all it contains, and let the Lord God be a witness against you, the Lord, from his holy temple. For behold, the Lord is coming forth from his place. He will come down and tread on the high places of the earth. Does everyone appreciate the imagery there? The Lord is in heaven, but the Lord's going to come down and trample on the high places of the earth. What are the high places that you read about in the Old Testament? Are places of worship, were they legitimate places of worship? No, in fact, most of the time these high places were the sacred sites for pagan worship. And even sometimes when they would be used for Yahweh worship, what had the law of Moses said about that? Ultimately, they were supposed to be worshiping at the central sanctuary, which of course ultimately is in Jerusalem. And so what you've got are all these high places on the earth that are false places of worship. So here's the imagery, Yahweh coming down from heaven and just walking, trampling on all of those high places. Verse 4, the mountains will melt under him, and the valleys will be split like wax before the fire, like water poured down a steep place. All of this is for the rebellion of Jacob and for the sins of the house of Israel. What is the rebellion of Jacob? Is it not Samaria? What is the high place of Judah? Is it not Jerusalem? For I will make Samaria a heap of ruins in the open country, planting places for a vineyard. I will pour her stones down into the valley and will lay bare her foundations. All of her idols will be smashed, all of her earnings will be burned with fire, and all of her images I will make desolate. For she collected them from a harlot's earnings, and to the earnings of a harlot they will return. So do you see this vivid condemnation of the northern kingdom? And Samaria is going to be judged, and everything that she has as a result of a harlot's earnings. What former prophet does that remind you of? Hosea, sure. The whole book of Hosea talking about the nation of Israel playing the harlot, okay, committing adultery against God. And so that's the same point that's being made here. And so as you go back to verse 5, the rebellion of the northern kingdom of Israel is Samaria. And look at the parallel at the end of verse 5. What is the high place of Judah? Is it not Jerusalem? Isn't that ironic? Jerusalem was the legitimate high place. And yet the implication is God has something against Jerusalem too. And as we go through Micah's prophecy, what we're going to see is that that's exactly the case. And so God's judgment is coming upon Samaria and Judah. All right. I want you to skip down here to chapter 1, verses 8 and following. Really a very interesting section, I think, of Micah's prophecy. You have to appreciate some of the terminology here to appreciate what he's doing. Verse 8, because of this I must lament and wail. I must go barefoot and naked. I must make a lament like the jackals and a mourning like the ostriches. For her wound is incurable. For it has come to Judah. It has reached the gate of my people, even to Jerusalem. And I want you to begin to see how the messages of these prophets build upon one another. This is one reason why I'm wanting us to do this overview. Look at his language, verse 8. Because of this, I must lament and wail. I must go barefoot and naked. Does that ring a bell with anybody, by any chance? Do any of you know of a prophet who was giving a message of impending judgment from God and how the armies were going to come in and destroy the people and they would go around barefoot and naked? And to illustrate that point, that's how the prophet, for I guess it was 3 years, went around publicly. Isaiah 20. That's what Isaiah did. I'm not sure that it means he went about totally naked. I think the point is, like in his loincloth, stripped of all the things that you would have, that you would need to protect you from the elements. And the whole point of Isaiah was, that's what's going to happen to all of us when the Assyrian armies come in and just devastate us, because you're not repenting of your sins. And that's what God had Isaiah do. That's a pretty graphic way to illustrate it. Remember how, who was the prophet who did something similar, not taking off clothes, but putting on a particular item of clothing to illustrate the devastation that was going to come through in the hard economic times? Elijah especially. Now other prophets did it too, but Elijah especially, what did he wear? All right, an animal skin, a hairy garment. Okay, John the Baptist did the same thing for the same reason. To illustrate the point that's how destitute the people were going to be. That's how great the economic plight was going to be. They wouldn't have any of their regular clothing and their material goods. It would all be taken away from them. And so they'd be happy to put an animal skin around their naked body. And so that's what's going on. Well, okay, Micah is playing off of that same idea. And if you appreciate that Micah is a contemporary of Isaiah, then it just all makes sense. He says, I must lament and wail. I must go barefoot and naked because of the sin of the people. Okay, making a play off of Isaiah's message. Verse 9, for her wound is incurable. For it has come to Judah, it has reached the gate of my people, even to Jerusalem. Tell it not in Gath, weep not at all. At Beth Laafra, roll yourself in the dust. Go on your way, inhabitant of Shephir, in shameful nakedness, and so on. And to appreciate what he's doing, he's making puns. He's making plays off the names of these various cities in the area of Judah. Gath, along the Mediterranean coast, Gath means wine press. The next one, Beth Laafra, is house to dust, or house in reference to dust, something along that line is what that name of the city means. And so what he's talking about is the idea of making a play off wine press and the idea of something being squeezed to the point that it just begins to, the juice comes out, just like when you're so tense and you finally just can't take it and you cry. And then Beth Laafra, roll yourself in the dust. Well, that's the name of the city. Shephir is fair and beautiful. That's what that Hebrew word meant. And so he says, go on your way, inhabitant of Shephir, in shameful nakedness. So he's, the name of your city is fair or beautiful, but you're going to be in shame and nakedness. He's making a play off of the name of each of these cities. It's kind of like if somebody came in our area and said, I'm going to brand Brandon with the judgment of God or something like that. Kind of making a play off of that. So that's what he does. I'm not going to take time to go through all of these. But that's what all of these names of these cities in Hebrew mean. And he makes a play off of all of that. Now, why is he singling out all of these cities and making a play about all these terrible things in reference to the names of these cities? Because all these cities are going to be destroyed. When the Assyrians come through, they're all going to be devastated. Now, what do you know historically took place after Micah gave this prophecy? What was the major historical calamity that befell the nation of Judah during his lifetime? Not the southern kingdom. Israel got carried away. In 721 BC, the northern kingdom was carried away into Assyrian exile. But what befell Judah? Okay, 701. This thing will work. 701 BC, that's when Sennacherib, the Assyrian king, brought his armies through Judah and just began to attack city after city after city and just destroy them all. So that's exactly what Micah had been saying was going to happen. All these cities are going to be cities where calamity has befallen them. And they're going to be in ruins when the Assyrians come through and bring God's judgment. Now let me just kind of tell you a little bit about historically what happened. And I want to show you some things. I've made reference to this in the last couple of classes. But in 701 BC, that's when the Assyrian force came through and they had already conquered Israel 20 years before. But Sennacherib's forces are coming and they're coming down this major roadway that ultimately would take you where? If you just kept going. All right, Egypt. And that's the ultimate prize. What's the last fortified city in Judah that's really, so to speak, on the border between Judah and Egypt territory? Anyone know the name? Lachish. It's one of the cities that he mentioned. I had it up on the slide a moment ago. Lachish, it's like over here. It's not on the map. That's where the major force of Sennacherib comes, and they surround Lachish, and they besiege Lachish. And finally, Lachish falls. A smaller contingent he sends to Jerusalem, and that contingent surrounds the city and demands the city surrender, or else they're going to be destroyed. And so, this is the devastation that Sennacherib brings in 701 BC. And I wanted to show you some of this. I've showed those who have been members here for several years have seen this before. This is the site of Lachish. And you can see this is a tell. And the city was built on top of the hill there. You know, Jesus had said a city set on a hill cannot be hid. Well, that's where they would chiefly build these fortified cities. Those are the ruins of Lachish. Let's see if I can back up and look at that. This area right here is the area where the Assyrians built up the mound so they could bring their battering rams up there to the walls to begin to breach the walls of that city. And how we know about this, not just from the biblical account in Kings, but Sennacherib, when he got back to Nineveh, his palace, he had his artisans make a wall mural, a massive mural along that wall, commemorating the extent of his military campaign, which was Lachish. And that's what all of this is. And I showed you that the other day. You can see here the Assyrian battering ram, and they're trying to breach a hole in the walls here. There's the Judean men of Lachish desperately trying to defend the city. They're shooting their arrows there. You can see that. And they've got torches that they're throwing down and rocks and that kind of thing. There's a better picture of the battering ram. And these murals are sort of atemporal. This is the aftermath of the battle. It's all the same picture. But here's the aftermath of the battle. And these are the prisoners who are being taken away into Assyrian exile. And those who fought against them and were killed, their corpses were impaled upon stakes, set up for everyone to look at, and said, this is what happens when you mess with Assyria. And so, you know, this is what the book of Kings is talking about, and it's what Micah had been prophesying about. A lot of people don't realize that the southern kingdom, a major portion of them were taken away into Assyrian exile too. People always think, oh, southern kingdom, Babylonian exile. Well, yeah, but before that, a major portion of Judah was taken away into Assyrian exile, and the people of Lachish were among them. And so that's the depiction of these exiles. And just imagine if a foreign nation came in to our area and uprooted all of us from our homes, and we were taken away into a foreign nation, and we would never see our land again. And that's what's going on here. And this picture always gets me. This is a Judean nobleman of Lachish. You can tell by his fancy clothes. But he's a prisoner now, and he's going away into Assyrian exile. He'll never come home again. And here are his children, and his little son is grabbing onto dad's tunic. Kind of the way a little child grabs onto mama's dress or mama's apron. That's what Micah was talking about. Lachish was one of the cities that he mentioned. And this is it. This is the prism of Sennacherib. And this is probably one of several markers that he had made and distributed throughout his empire, telling about his great exploits. And he talks about how he came into Judah. He says, as for Hezekiah the Jew, who did not submit to my yoke, 46 of his strong-walled cities, as well as the smaller cities in their neighborhood, like all those that Micah had talked about, I besieged and took. Hezekiah himself, like a caged bird, I shut up in Jerusalem, his royal city. And that's exactly what the book of Kings says the Assyrian armies did. Did Jerusalem fall to Sennacherib? No. But the entire nation of Judah, as a result of this devastation of 701, the entire nation and its territory just kind of shrinks overnight. And basically, Judah, in the aftermath, is Jerusalem, which is the only major city that survived devastation, was not destroyed. So Judah is like Jerusalem and just the environs around it. That's it. After 701, that's it. Because everything else has just been wiped out. And the citizenry have been taken away into Assyrian exile. And you got a few paupers who are wandering around, you know, searching for shelter. But I mean, this just think about those tsunami victims. And it's just everything's gone. And they're wandering around just trying to somehow find shelter and clothing and just to survive and find food day by day. I mean, that's what's going on here. And all this is the judgment that Hosea had talked about, that Amos had talked about, that Isaiah had talked about, that Micah has been talking about. And so this is what happens. So this is why it's so important to understand these prophets and understand the historical events that are going on, what they're prophesying about, and how these prophecies then are fulfilled. Question about any of that? Okay. All right. I want you to go over to chapter 3. Now, chapter 3 is like the second section of Micah's oracle, where he talks about the present devastation, but also future exaltation. So look at chapter 3, verse 9, beginning. Now hear this, heads of the house of Jacob and rulers of the house of Israel, who abhor justice and twist everything that is straight, who build Zion with bloodshed and Jerusalem with violent injustice. Her leaders pronounce judgment for a bribe. Her priests instruct for a price, and her prophets divine for money. Yet they lean on the Lord, saying, is not the Lord in our midst? Calamity will not come upon us. Therefore, on account of you. Zion will be plowed as a field. Jerusalem will become a heap of ruins. And the mountain of the temple will become high places of the forest. So many of the prophets are condemning the people of their day, not simply for idolatry. Oh yeah, idolatry, forsaking Yahweh for other gods, sure. But for social injustices, where the people that you would look to lead righteously and with integrity, they're only concerned about themselves. The judges, you have to bribe them to get a judgment. And you give them enough money, they'll side in your favor. And you're a little poor guy who was mistreated, and you don't have any money to pay off the judge. You're sunk. I mean, all this corruption. And that had become the norm. And the priests are supposed to teach the people the law, but they won't teach people the law unless what? Pay me first. You know, their motive is not to help people learn God's law. They're using God's word as a way to get money. And the prophets are going to prophesy for money. And you think maybe the prophet, if you pay him enough, will give you a favorable prophecy. Sure, I mean, he'll just make the prophecy be whatever you want to hear. And so it just creates the illusion that God is behind it. And that's what they're saying. Is not the Lord in our midst? We're the territory of Yahweh. This is Jerusalem. This is the place where Yahweh's temple is. This is where he dwells. He doesn't dwell in any other nation. They don't even know Yahweh. But this is his holy place. So there's no way that he will ever allow calamity to come upon Jerusalem. And I don't know, maybe after 701 BC, people still began to say that and maybe said that because, hey, Jerusalem was spared. Well, it was spared in 701. But look at what Micah says here. Therefore, on account of you, Zion will be plowed as a field. Jerusalem will become a heap of ruins. And the mountain of the temple will become high places of a forest. Would you expect a prophet of Yahweh, a prophet of any god, to pronounce a message of doom upon the sanctuary of that god? Unheard of in the ancient world. I mean, the prophets of Baal never prophesied, Baal's temple will be destroyed. Oh no, my goodness. That would never be the politically correct prophecy. But this is what Yahweh's prophets keep saying. And this is the first time that a prophet in Israel specifically foretells that Jerusalem, the capital city where the temple is, it's going to be judged too. Micah's the first one. Now, others have talked about Judah being devastated, but Micah is the first prophet who says Jerusalem is going to fall. God's going to bring judgment upon Jerusalem, even his own sacred city, where his soul temple dwells. So this is just really impressive that Micah is prophesying all of this. Why did Jerusalem not fall to King Sennacherib of Assyria in 701? A couple of reasons. 2 Kings 19 talks about Hezekiah's leadership. Hezekiah did not follow the wicked policy of his father Ahaz. Hezekiah said when he became king, I'm going to follow Yahweh and I'm going to serve him. And he wasn't always perfect in everything that he did, but overall, he was a faithful servant of Yahweh, and Hezekiah prayed that Yahweh would spare the city, and he answered Hezekiah's prayer. That's the reason, and the only reason, repentance, why Jerusalem did not fall prey to the Assyrians in 701 BC, just like all the other cities did. And I want you to notice this. Turn over to Jeremiah 26. Now, we haven't got to Jeremiah yet because Jeremiah is prophesying a century later. But I want to just jump ahead in time to, you know, century down the line to Jeremiah and his day and look at Jeremiah 26 and go down to verse 17. And this is in the context when Jeremiah has publicly prophesied that Jerusalem is going to be judged by God. Well, oh, unheard of. You can't get away with prophesying something like that. That's being a traitor to your own nation. It's being a traitor to the God that you say that you're a prophet of. Okay, verse 17. Then some of the elders of the land rose up and spoke to all the assembly of the people, saying, Micah of Moresheth prophesied in the days of Hezekiah, king of Judah, and he spoke to all the people of Judah, saying, Thus the Lord of hosts has said, Zion will be plowed as a field, and Jerusalem will become a heap of ruins, and the mountain of the house as the high places of a forest. Making a reference back to the very prophecy in Micah that we've been looking at. Now look at verse 19. Here's what the elders say about that. Did Hezekiah, king of Judah, and all Judah put Micah to death? See, that's what they wanted to do with Jeremiah. He's a traitor. Put him to death. Did Hezekiah put Micah to death? Did Hezekiah not fear the Lord and entreat the favor of the Lord? And the Lord changed his mind about the misfortune which he had pronounced against them. So why did Jerusalem not fall in 701 BC? Because Hezekiah believed Micah's prophecy. Hezekiah was following the prophecies of Isaiah and Micah, and Hezekiah repented. And when Micah pronounced this unheard of judgment upon the very city itself, Hezekiah did not retaliate and put him to death, but instead he listened to the message and God relented. God said, I'm not going to punish this city. Now, later, Jerusalem will fall to the Babylonians when the people just get so bad again. But this is what's going on, and I think that's an interesting point there where the people in Jeremiah's day, they had Micah's prophecy. It had been preserved. See? And so they're referring back to what Micah had prophesied a century before. All right, question or comment about that? Now, look at the very next verse in Micah 4, verse 1. Told you that this section, present devastation, but the promise of future exaltation. Okay, he's just prophesied that Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. God's going to bring judgment on it. But, very next verse, and it will come about in the last days that the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the mountains, and the peoples will stream to it. Let me keep going here. Many nations will come and say, come, and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, and to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, that we may walk in his paths. For from Zion will go forth the law, even the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. This is an amazing prophecy. Micah prophesies Jerusalem's going to be judged by God. It's going to be destroyed. But He says, in the last days, which is a vague way the prophets used of saying, sometime in the distant future when God brings all of his prophecies to their fruition, in the end time, the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the mountains. What does that mean? The mountain Zion, the mountain of the house of the Lord, will be established as the chief of the mountains. In the ancient world, the mountains, we talked about it at the beginning of our class. Those are the high places. Those are the worship sites. You always build your temple on a mountaintop, on a hill, on a high place. Okay, but Zion, Jerusalem, that mountain in the last days will be viewed as the chief of the mountains. And all the peoples will stream to it. When you see peoples, plural, in the Old Testament, what's that mean? The nations, the Gentiles. Okay? It's like when you see nations, plural. Okay, that's the Gentiles. Peoples, plural. You got the Jewish people, then all the other peoples out there, all the other nations. And the peoples will stream to it. Isn't that remarkable? He's prophesying that in the last days, these nations who do not honor God now, who do not worship Yahweh now, don't care anything about him at all, they're going to one day honor him and recognize that the God of Jerusalem is the true God, and they're going to come to learn his law, even though they are Gentiles. Has that been fulfilled? How do you know? Okay. Okay. How about looking at you and the people sitting next to you? What are you? Aren't you among the peoples? Aren't you Gentiles? And what are you doing here tonight? I mean, you've come here. We're studying Jewish scriptures. We're studying the law of Yahweh that was issued forth from Mount Zion. Why in the world are you people doing that? Your ancestors didn't worship this Jewish God. Why are you? You see the point? That's what Micah was saying. And that prophecy he gives right here, you may remember that as being exactly the prophecy that Isaiah gives in Isaiah 2. In fact, probably we know this prophecy more as, or more from Isaiah 2, but it's word for word what you see in Isaiah chapter 2, verse 1 and following. In the last days, Gentiles are going to come and honor Yahweh and seek to be taught by him. And that's what we're doing as Christians. We are bowing down to a Jewish king, Jesus. We are studying scriptures that are Jewish scriptures written for the most part by Jewish men by the inspiration of God. I mean, see, we don't really, we're so used to that, it just seems normal, you know. But you have to kind of back up and look at this. From the broader point of view, it's remarkable what we are doing here. And we're not the only ones. People all over the world, for 2,000 years now, since Pentecost, have been doing exactly what we're doing. And that's exactly the way it ought to be. Ironically, this, when Micah prophesied this, would have been an amazing prophecy. But if Yahweh is the one true God, shouldn't every creature bow down before him? Should that be unusual? No, the unusual thing would be for nations not to know him and not to serve him. But that's what Micah is saying. In the last days, everything's going to be set aright. Everything will be as it should be. And all the peoples will look to the God of Jerusalem as the one true God and seek to be taught by him and will honor him as God. That's the way things ought to be. And that's what Micah says is going to happen. He says Jerusalem's going to be destroyed first, though. But in the last days, a remarkable turn. turnaround. Okay. Isn't that neat? I mean, don't you get excited about this? I mean, I just, what a great privilege we have to be part of this. You're the fulfillment of that prophecy. It's not just people back in Acts 2. I mean, they are also, but you know, it's more than just 3,000 people on Pentecost Day that fulfill this. You fulfill this. I fulfill that. It's just, I think we need to appreciate our privileged position. What a great gift of God that we're able to be doing this. Anyway, okay. Let's go ahead and keep going here. I may have to preach a sermon on Joel because I'm never going to get to Joel. But that's okay. Go over to chapter 4, verse 9, and this is interesting. Micah says, "Now, why do you cry out loudly? Is there no king among you? Or has your counselor perished? That agony has gripped you like a woman in childbirth." What's he lamenting there? They don't have what? They don't have leadership. They don't have a king. Well, now, when Micah's prophesying, didn't they have a king? Didn't he say that he was prophesying in verse 1 during the reigns of who? Jotham and Ahaz and Hezekiah? I mean, they... Well, but is Hezekiah a great king? I mean, he's faithful to Yahweh, but I mean, is he a great king? He's got a little nothing nation now. Just devastated in 701. His whole territory just shrunk. So, and even before him, and I'm not exactly sure, you know, when in Micah's life he gave this prophecy. If he gives it during the lifetime of Ahaz, Ahaz isn't even following Yahweh. What kind of king is that? He's bowing down to pagan deities. Yeah. Can't you just see faithful people saying, "I wish we had a king. I wish we had a leader that we could be proud of that would be leading us." Okay, well, but what's so amazing is it even gets worse. Because as you keep going in history, after the lifetime of Micah, the Davidic kings get worse and worse and worse, maybe one or two exceptions, but basically they just keep going downhill. And finally, what happens to that Davidic throne? It gets seemingly wiped out by the Babylonians. So, if the people were crying out for a king in Micah's day, boy, they were really crying out later on for a king. Can't our nation produce a king? Can't it give birth to a king? He talks about agony has gripped you like a woman in childbirth. And that's a common figure you see throughout the prophets of the nation and all of its struggles, like a woman in labor pains. And you'd hope that she would give birth, the nation would give birth to some great leader that will rescue them from all this. But so far, they're in labor, but they haven't had any great leader come up. Okay, but keep going. It's in the same context. Chapter 5, verse 2, and you know this prophecy. But it's in this context that Micah gives it. "But as for you, Bethlehem, Ephrathah, too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you one will go forth for me to be a ruler in Israel. His goings forth are from long ago, from the days of eternity. Therefore, God will give them up until the time when she who is in labor has borne a child. Then the remainder of his brethren will return to the sons of Israel, and he will arise and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God, and they will remain because at that time he will be great to the ends of the earth. This one will be our peace." So what does Micah say? We don't have much of a king now, and as it turns out, they weren't going to have any king at all in the very near future. But he prophesies from little Bethlehem, the nation would give birth finally to a great, great king. And ultimately, who's that prophecy talking about? The Messiah who would come. Who would be a Davidic king of that Davidic lineage. Okay, but now think about this. He's going to be born in Bethlehem, little Bethlehem. Now, David was born in Bethlehem, right? What about all the other Davidic kings after David? Solomon and Rehoboam and Asa and Abijah and all that. Where were they born? Jerusalem, because David was raised up from obscurity to be this great king, and Jerusalem was the capital city. What's the implication? If the great king would come from Bethlehem again, it's like the kingship has fallen apart and now God has to start over and raise a second David up from little Bethlehem again from obscurity. And Bethlehem was a nothing village. From obscurity to then lift him up to the throne. And that's what he's saying. The throne of David will be restored to its former grandeur and even greater when this ultimate king comes. And he'll be the ultimate righteous leader, not like the sorry leaders that the nation had in Micah's day. Okay. That's the context of that prophecy. We know the prophecy from Matthew chapter 1, but we probably don't appreciate the context when Micah gave it. Okay? All right. Read through the prophecy of Micah. It's just really, really fascinating. All right, thank you, folks.